This episode is brought to you by Thorne, and I have some incredible news for any of you that are in the military, first responder, or medical professions. In an effort to give back, Thorne is now offering you an ongoing 25% off each and every one of your purchases of their incredible nutritional solutions. Now, Thorne is the official supplement of CrossFit, the UFC, the Mayo Clinic, the Human Performance Project, and multiple special operations organizations. I myself have used them for several years, and that is why I brought them on as a sponsor. Some of my favorite products they have are their Multivitamin Elite, their Whey Protein, the Super EPA, and then most recently, Cinequil. As a firefighter, a stuntman, and a martial artist, I've had my share of brain trauma and sleep deprivation, and Cinequil is their latest brain health supplement. Now, to qualify for the 35% off, go to thorne.com, thorne.com. Click on sign in and then create a new account. You will see the opportunity to register as a first responder or member of military. When you click on that, it will take you through verification with GovX. You'll simply choose a profession, provide one piece of documentation, and then you are verified for life. From that point onwards, you will continue to receive 35% off through Thorne. Now, for those of you who don't qualify, there is still the 10% off using the code BTS10, behind the shield 10, for a one-time purchase. Now, to learn more about Thorne, go to episode 323 of the Behind the Shield podcast with Joel Totoro and Wes Barnett. This episode is sponsored by Team Builder, yet another company that's doing great things for the first responder community. As a strength and conditioning coach myself who also trains tactical athletes, dissemination of wellness information is one of the biggest challenges. Now, Team Builder is the premier strength and conditioning software for tactical athletes, and there are several features that really impressed me. Firstly, there is a full exercise library, so you, the personal trainer, does not have to create that within your own department. Secondly, you can send out programming, but also individualize, which I love. So you blanket program for everyone. Now you can tweak based on someone's injury, someone's need to maybe drop some body composition, rather than having to write a program for every single person on their own. Team Builder also allows you to build custom questionnaires to collate health and wellness data. It integrates with wearables. And I think one of the most important things is obviously it tracks. To me, it's imperative that we as a profession start tracking our people from day one and then over the full span of their career, therefore catching potential wellness issues and injuries before they happen. Now, if you want to try Team Builder, they are offering you, the audience of the Behind the Shield podcast, a free 14-day trial to experience all of the features. And if you want to take a deeper dive into Team Builder, listen to episode 1032 with Melissa Mercado, or go to teambuilder.com. And I'll spell that to you because it's not as you'd think, teambuildr.com. Welcome to the Behind the Shield podcast. As always, my name's James Gearing, and this week it is my absolute honor to welcome on the show Marine combat veteran, tactical medic, and the man behind Warrior's Choice Foundation, Anthony Longo. Now, in this conversation, we discuss a host of topics, from his journey into the military, fire service paramedicine, the U.S. compound attack, working dogs, catharsis through canine therapy, and so much more. Now, before we get to this incredible conversation, as I say every week, please just take a moment. Go to whichever app you listen to this on, subscribe to the show, leave feedback, and leave a rating. Every single 5-star rating truly does elevate this podcast, therefore making it easier for others to find. And this is a free library of well over 1,000 episodes now. So all I ask in return is that you help share these incredible men and women's stories so I can get them to every single person on planet Earth who needs to hear them. So with that being said, I introduce to you Anthony Longo. Enjoy.
Hey, Well, Anthony, I want to start by saying two things. Firstly, thank you to our mutual friend, Patrick Burrows, for making the connection. And secondly, to welcome you onto the Behind the Shield podcast today.
Yeah, thank you, man. I appreciate being here. This is going to be fun. I've been looking forward to it. I know we've spent some time trying to connect on this, so I'm glad we were able to do it.
Absolutely. I think the last time we were supposed to, you got hit with jury duty right at the very last minute.
Yeah, I did. Yeah. And I didn't know when time was going to get out. So yeah, no, I appreciate you being patient.
Yeah, no, I'm going to knock on wood now because I've been a citizen now for several years and I haven't been hit yet. I know I'm on the chopping block at some point, but
it's coming.
All right. Well, very first question, where on planet Earth are we finding you today?
Right now I live in Jupiter, Florida.
Beautiful part of the state.
Yeah, just outside of West Palm Beach, north of, pretty much North County-ish in that vicinity. So it's been beautiful. Been here for like 20 years.
Brilliant. All right. Well, speaking of that, I'd love to start at the very beginning of your journey then. So tell me where you were born and tell me a little bit about your family dynamic, what your parents did, how many siblings?
Yeah. So I was born actually in Minneapolis, Minnesota. And as far as that goes, we moved back to New York where my family was from. And, you know, from there, it was just kind of growing up in a low middle of the road class family in upstate New York, Schenectady, New York, which is used to be the home of GE back in the day. And my mother, she was starting off to be a travel agent and then ended up going to work for the Department of Social Services, where she was connecting, you know, low income families with child support or not child support, but, you know, child programs for funding. And then my father, he was in with the county as a worker, shift supervisor for their like maintenance team.
Many of the towns and cities where we saw American industry leave for whatever reason, especially if we went overseas, there was a deficit. There was a void left. And, you know, a lot of times we found, you know, poverty and addiction and gangs and those kind of things starting to emerge. Was that the case in your city?
You know, you can only imagine, you know, with General Electric being a huge player in that community and watching those jobs leave, there was a huge difference in, you know, obviously traffic patterns, but, you know, what it did to the economy. So for where I went to high school, you know, I went to Scotia Glenville. I started off in Scotia and then moved over back to Schenectady. And that's where I ended up graduating from. So long story short, Schenectady used to be Linton High School, home of like Pat Riley. And, you know, so in essence, you know, once all of that happened, you know, the inner city definitely moved up into our area. So there were a lot of gangs. There were, you know, at the point where I was in high school, I mean, I think we were 2,500 students alone in that high school. So you can imagine just with anything. So I was kind of grateful. I didn't grow up in like a private school. You know, I kind of had to learn the ropes and, you know, mind P's and Q's, but also have a little bit of a street mindset to navigate those groups of who to be involved with and who to stay away from.
When you think about like the pushback against, you know, not sending jobs overseas or you know, in the argument to send jobs overseas, oh, well, then my car will be a little cheaper or my iPod will be a little cheaper. So yeah, but at what cost to this country? And if you look at a lot of the cities and towns that had mining, that had, you know, Detroit and some of these other places that had the motor industry, the, you know, the ripple effect of saving a few dollars by exporting, I mean, is a generational issue now.
Totally. And you can understand it, you know, running businesses and organizations, it's, you know, even though you're running an organization, you're still running a business because you still need money to operate. You still have operating costs. You still have all the things that associate to that. So even a small dip in the economy, especially over even the last several years, you know, post COVID with the recession that we were facing with inflation, you know, you could feel it through donors because it's like not too many people could give to charitable organizations because they were just, you know, they themselves were trying to salvage and make do with their money, which is perfectly normal and perfectly fine.
Absolutely. Well, going back to school age, what were you playing and doing as far as exercise and sport?
Yeah. So in sports, I was big into baseball, loved basketball until I obviously went to a different school where, you know, if you're not 6'7", being able to dunk the ball and, you know, have handles, like, not gonna matter. So then I started playing football, and I got brought up as a sophomore, started varsity as a sophomore, was one of the again brought up for varsity baseball as a sophomore, and just kind of used those platforms to kind of grow into who I was, you know, essentially going to become with work ethic and, you know, the different coaches that I've had over the years. I contribute a lot of my drive and work ethic towards them, and having those authoritarian coaches like, hey, like, get off your soapbox, like, continue to push. And then, you know, actually during football, I actually tore my Leonard labrum, which is the cartilage inside your shoulder, protects the socket. And, you know, trying to come back and becoming a pitcher, and then slowly that being taken away because I couldn't get the ball over the plate. And then just having to figure out and re-identify myself as a first baseman, was a challenge in itself. But, you know, I kind of knew at that point, athletics for me were kind of coming to an end. Once you're at that point in your high school career where it's like, all right, well, I'm not going to college for this because of this injury. So let's face, like, what are we going to do? What's our next steps? And during that time, you know, we have this like poolee program where the military comes in. And if you're interested, you get opportunities to collaborate with them and go out and see what they're about and kind of just slowly get indoctrinated with the culture of what they want. And, you know, from there, it was like, you know, the Marine Corps stuck out to me with having, you know, nice uniforms, always, you know, dudes just stoic and, very just to the point. And, you know, I went out and researched and did a little bit more, with a focus towards the Marine Corps than I did with any of the other branches of service, because those at that point, you know, for in my optics, they were the best of the best from a large group. And that's where I, you know, I was like, you know what, these guys are going to go off the war. They're going to do this. They're going to fight. And this is what I want for me. This is how I see myself, or this is the group that I can align with. And I think it was after I graduated, I went to a prep school, a 2-year school, just a, you know, community college. They have a great baseball program, and found out quickly within the first semester. I was like, you know what, this is not for me. This is not where I want to be. This is not the life that I want to live. It's not the area I want to live in. I need something different. And I literally went down to the recruiting station and was like, hey, where do I need to sign? How long is it going to take me to get out of here? What are the next steps? And that was right in 2003 when I did all that. So the war had already kind of kicked off. We had 9/11. So it was kind of funny because the one recruiter was like, well, trying to go through his motions of recruiting, like, do you want to do your at least 12 tabs, travel, this and that, teamwork, like, which ones stick out to? I'm like, buddy, what don't you understand?
You know, like, where do I sign?
where do I sign? Like, what do I have to do? And we finally got through the process, and I ended up leaving in February of 2004 for Parris Island, which is down in South, like Beaufort, just outside of Beaufort, South Carolina. And that was a trip.
Well, just pulling the clock back a little bit. Talk to me about 9/11, that day through your eyes.
Through my eyes, 9/11, freshman, sophomore year. And it was like, what the fuck just happened? Like, are you kidding me? Like, how, wait, what? And there was a nuclear power plant over by us in upstate New York. So everybody was kind of worried, like, hey, what's happening here? And we were just kind of like, all right, well, do we go back to school? Do we not go back to school? So I ended up cutting class the last half of that day just to sit and watch and see what was happening. Because, you know, my family, my uncle was a firefighter, so I didn't know if he was going to get called in to go down there. And you can just see, you know, a city in total chaos. Like, what's going on? And then the collapse of the towers happened. And then all of a sudden you start seeing other channels between the Pentagon that popping up and seeing what how coordinated that attack was on U.S. soil. really was just like, I don't want to say it wasn't like infuriating. It was just kind of like that doesn't happen here. Like that's, no one's going to come into our house and do something like that. So it's like, what's the next step? And, you know, for me, it was just, obviously I had to wait a couple of years, but then I knew it's like, there was a bigger purpose for me to be like, all right, I can't do this. Like this didn't mean anything to me at that point.
So which role did you find yourself filling within the Marines themselves?
So when I enlisted, I actually enlisted as a radio operator. So my duties were, what I was looking at was, hey, I wanted to go into the infantry in some capacity. I didn't necessarily want to be directly to infantry because I wanted to have something that was transferable post work. And, you know, looking at what I could do, the communication field really kind of gave a little bit more of a broad picture into where I could go and what industry I could get involved with. So went in as an infantry communication specialist. Once I finished boot camp, went to school. I was out in 29 Palms for about three months. And I mean, that was shocking because it's like you're rolling in at 3 a.m. and it's 120 degrees out. And you're like, wait, what? Where am I going? Like, where is this? And, you know, every day that we went, because I ended up going up there to school, it was June through September. So I was just like, every day was like a black flag day where you're not supposed to do training. And then it's just like, our instructor was a former recon guy, so he didn't care. He was just like, yeah, okay, black flag, sure it is. But it was just, it was an experience in itself to be able to automatically kind of jump into the travel from, you know, leaving MEPS, going into boot camp, getting done. And, you know, there's a whole system and process that goes with that. Finally finishing that, feeling confident and validated enough for myself of like, I just completed something that was difficult mentally, but not like physically challenging, as some would say. It's more of like, hey, just forget what you know and just readapt and apply the principles that they're trying to teach you. And I took hold of that. And you know, next step was, once we finished school, we got to pick our duty station, so where we wanted to go. And it was either going to go artillery or infantry. So I was just like, well, this is easy choice. So it was also nice because then I was on the East Coast. So then on, you know, 96s or 72s, when we get our time off, I could just get in a vehicle and just drive straight up. There was probably going to be more guys from the East Coast that I could, you know, resonate with and create new lasting friendships with. So that was the path and the reasoning behind me choosing to go over to 2-6 on the East Coast out of Camp Lejeune. And I checked in, I think it was mid-September of 2004 to my unit.
And so was Fallujah where you were first deployed, if I got that right?
Yeah, so we did our initial push to Fallujah in 2000, well, basically my 21st birthday, September 19th, 2005. I was actually in transit, and, you know, with the time change and everything else like that, it was like, hey, my birthday was spent on a back of a 7-ton cramped in with a bunch of dudes cruising into Fallujah. So no Vegas for me and drinking and anything else like that. I was just like, all right, here we go.
Well, I always ask these two questions to people that deployed to combat. The first, because it's a two-part question. The reason I ask this is, when you are back home, you have a very polarized view of war. It's either kill them all, let God sort them out, or they're all baby killers. And in the middle are our men, women, arguably children that we send overseas with the flag on their shoulder to go fight for this country and protect people of that country. So regardless of the politics that sent you there, because I think we're becoming a lot more clear now as to some of the distortions of the 9/11 and Iraq journey. But regardless of that, was there a point where you realized there were some horrific people that did need to be taken care of?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, there are bad people out there that need to be taken down. You know, there's no way around it. And, you know, fortunately, being involved or being with entities that are sent off to go and do that type of work, so that people here in your hometown and people that you care, people that you don't know about, people who can live that life of not even being able to conceptualize what that takes to be there, is the reason why I feel as though people like myself and other people who serve in communal capacities or whatever the case is, feel the need to serve them or to serve that purpose. And some aren't. When they get there, they're just like, oh shit, no, this is not for me either. So, you know, it's, you generally, you know, for me, it was like, I was glad I was able to be put into that role and to serve alongside some amazing human beings and some not so amazing, but, that's anywhere you go. And it was just, you had a mutual bond and it was between one another. And you didn't want to let one guy down because you were all part of this system and a part of that team. And I think once you get to that level, you're able to overcome things as a group more so than just individual thoughts, because we, you know, we had guys who didn't believe in being there and what we were doing. And, you know, you have those views, but you're just, that's the great thing about this country and why I chose to serve it, is like, you have the ability to be objective in your thought ideology and where that places you, so that when it's all said and done, you were able to still hold true to your values and complete your contract and go move on and go do what you wanted to do.
Well, the other side of that question that, again, we don't really hear, you know, relayed from the combat zones around the world, is moments of kindness and compassion. I've had so many examples from people of all branches, from all countries. What are some moments of kindness and compassion that you remember from that deployment?
I think, you know, when it first started off, it was, yeah, it's like, hey, this is real. Like, we're here now. Let's keep our head on a swivel, do what we have to do. You know, and you're trying to bring in these ethos to these villages and to these people who don't know much about anything with what's actually happening. They know their way of life, and then we have ours, and we're the invaders, we're the infidels that are coming in. So they're trying to protect their sovereign land. You know, so you try to be hospitable in that sense to kind of integrate with what they're doing based on your mission profile. And for us, it was like, hey, look, you know, whatever, if you have a cell phone, if they're doing this, that, it's the ROEs kind of set the tone for what our mission was over there. And unfortunately, you know, looking at it to a point where, you know, you have a group of kids who one of our buddies was throwing candy down. Next thing you know, he's posted on Orgus while getting shot in the head. So it goes from you trying to have some empathy for these people to understand, like, you know, you guys just got rolled through. All right, now we're back here. We're trying to help out and assist in a capacity. And then next thing you know, incidents like that happen. It changes your dynamic and it changes your focus to where it's like, hey, look, now it's on. Now nobody cares about anything that's happening here because you know, took one of our dudes. Now you're going to feel the wrath of what we have to bring and why we're here in the first place.
So how long did you find yourself there and you know, where were you assigned next?
So we were in country for 7 months. Fortunately, the Marines only have to do 7-8 months, unlike the Army, who's stuck in certain places for like 15 months, which is just like god awful. And then you get to come home and then have to go back. But we were there for right up until Memorial Day, where we were able to come back. And then after that, next thing you know, we're in New York City doing Fleet Week in 2006. So, you know, we had a pretty good deployment. And following that, next thing you know, we're in New York City at Ground Zero at 9/11, like seeing it all firsthand of 4 years later, of all the work that's being done to rebuild, guys getting promoted in sacred lands. So it's like, it was just all so much to kind of to take in. But you were so proud of the service and the guys that you're around, because like, hey, we just got back from a pretty good deployment and now we're here. And this is kind of what drove us, or at least was a bookmark and earmark of why we wanted to serve.
So did you deploy again or did you transition out after that?
No. So we had 1 year and about 9 months in between, we did another workup and then we redeployed back to the same AO. So we were operating back in Fallujah again. This time it was, pretty much from the beginning of 2007, right up until about October, November. And then I was interested in actually transferring over to, I was going to reenlist out there because they were handing out signing bonuses. So I was like, all right, well, I want to go and, be a firefighter, first responder, whatever the case is there. Let me see what's available. And because I had picked up rank and I was ended up going to be getting out as a sergeant in E5 at that time, there was no billets available for me to transfer over into a new MOS to take on that new job. So I ended up going through the motions of, listening to guys' horror stories before of like trying to get, to check out of the unit and everything else like that. And I knew coming back home off leave, everybody's going to be on libo. I was going to get extended. So I started kind of checking out while I was in Iraq and nailing down the people. It's like, well, I know you're going to be here. I'm going to go in and listen to your sales pitch. But then it's like, no, thanks. Here you go. Can you sign my checkout sheet, please? And then when I got back, it was just quickly, I think I was home for maybe a month. And then I was checked out, enrolled in school, and I was starting my EMT classes down in Palm Beach State in January of 2008. So my EAS date wasn't until February. So I was collecting full pay, full benefits while I was on the beach, just hanging out, studying EMT classes. So it was nice.
What was the difference between the first deployment to Fallujah and the second one in Iraq?
I think the first one was a little more offensive for us. We didn't have as many restrictions as we did in the second half. The second half was more of like, we're here to help reintegrate the people that are coming back in. So everybody we locked up and put away in 05, 06, oh, well, yeah, now they're going to get out. Now they're going to come back in. And now it's like you have to start giving them back more leash to assist them in redeveloping and rebuilding of their city, of their country. So there was, for us, we looked at it like we're more of a target. We're not a policing force. We're not supposed to be there. Marines were supposed to come in, demolish it, and get out. Not coming in and handing out bags of rice, talking to village elders, and trying to figure out what the political landscape is for the larger scale intel network that's created from the ground force up. So that was different in hindsight.
Yeah. A lot of people in the military, also in, first responder professions, that transition out is very jarring. You've got that, identity piece. You've got that tribal element of being part of a cohesive unit. You've got the shared purpose. And then a lot of people will say, then I was at the grocery store in Buffalo, New York. And, that's when a lot of them had this kind of downward spiral. What was your transition like, and did the fact that you were going into another similar profession make it easier for you?
I think the transition was, for me, looking back on it now, I didn't understand. I didn't know what I didn't know about something. It's just like, hey, look, now this job's over. Guess what? Now you have, here's your objectives. Here's your track. I had a plan exiting and I just needed to execute on those objectives to get to my final destination. In doing so, I started off with like 18 and a half credit hours. Like I was also taking additional courses to supplement what I was already taking on EMT because I felt as though I was seeing all of my friends and peers through high school graduating college, having degrees, getting set up with jobs. I felt like, well, I didn't do anything. Like, what am I doing? Like, I got to get my shit together and hurry up and make this happen so I can have a life, I can have a family, I can do all these things. So I buried myself in schoolwork, and it became difficult because I was very I felt like I was an outsider. I felt like I had seen a lot of things that a lot of people hadn't seen and they couldn't relate to. So for me to try to adjust and change my optics on real life back to now what's happening here, it was, I couldn't hide it. And I think my anxiety was, really through the roof. And, you go to the VA, you try everything, I couldn't sleep. And that was like, hey, take Ambien. I'm like, all right, well, try this. And that didn't work. I was like, look, I don't like this. I'm waking up too foggy. And then it was, all right, well, try this. And it's just like, all right, I'm done with this. I'm not going to do any of these meds. And I just tried to really just bury myself more into work and almost pretty much got burnt out by 2010, 2011, like right when I finished paramedic school, I was cashed. So it was, I would say I had a difficult transition because I didn't know what I didn't know. You know, you separate from the military with these classes first, you know, it's called SEPs and TAPs. And they're really, it's 2 days of SEPs, 3 days of TAPs. And then they basically say, hey, fill out everything for your VA, get all this done, write down everything. And then from here are the resources that are going to be available to you once you're out. Now go find them. And then you're like, all right, well, sweet. So you think you're so excited to get out. And, you know, when you do, you're finally like, you're out in the world and you're like, oh my God, now you have to, you don't account for the adjustment on the work ethic of others around you and seeing how people like take their time to do things versus in the military. It's like, your job is this, go do this. This is what you have to focus on. I think that was very difficult for me because I was like, well, why is this process? Why are all these all this red tape in the middle of me getting from here to here? Let's just go. So that was a transition for sure.
One of the things I didn't ask you about earlier, but this is such a kind of under-discussed element when it comes to military and first responder mental health, is so many of us have certain things happen when you were younger that if left unaddressed, contribute to our struggles once we're wearing the uniform. When you reflect back to your early life, were there any elements you think that fractured the foundation a little bit?
Absolutely. Yeah. You know, like I said, you know, grew up in low middle class. You know, we pretty much lived, I think when I moved back to New York, we were in Section 8 housing for the most part of what is looked at right now. And, you know, it was, separated from my father, or not really separated from my father, but it was like every other week that we got to see each other for a period of time until you're done with it. You know what I mean? It's hard to say, but once you hit a certain level of maturity, you're just kind of like I'm done going with this volley of back and forth with different households and three different Christmases and all this other stuff where you're just like, I'm good. And then, you know, I think with just the adjustment and being alone or finding myself involved with sports, that gave me the ability to kind of align myself with friends and the people that I like would care about or have that type of communal bond or tribe to overcome adversity and bounce things off of, because I was around them more so than some of my family, or I would rather have been around them more so than some of my family in those instances.
Absolutely. Well, speaking of tribes, walk me through your journey into the fire service. How was that transition into that profession?
Well, the transition into that was, it was not what I expected initially. For me being just, you know, green coming out, I was like, hey, look, here I am. I'm ready to do this. There was a big hiring freeze for 2008 through 2009 or 2010. And that's right around the time when I was going to school. So I was like, all right, this isn't too bad. So I went to a couple local departments, put in my application, got brought in. And I was just straightforward, like, hey, this is where I've been. Here's my most trying time. You know, I think at one point when I actually was like, hey, let me check out law enforcement side, maybe be a cop, do something. Almost had a panic attack inside of the thing because I forgot one thing on my application that I didn't put in. And I was just like, oh my God, like, wow, like, holy shit, like, can't believe that. So bombed that interview. And then when I got brought in for another one, I was just kind of very open, like, hey, here's everything that the VA has given me. Here's all of the things. Here's my experience. Here's a moment in time when I had to, you know, on the battlefield, this is what happened, this, that, and the other thing. And they're just kind of looking at me like, yeah, this is never going to pass. Like, it's never going to happen. So, I ended up going on and volunteering with the department, working with a chief who kind of brought me in and understood like where I was at, what my headspace was, and really kind of gave me the opportunity to surround myself with that group and then be able to kind of learn the culture. And then from there on, it was much easier. And at that point, I had an opportunity to go overseas and contract. And I was just like, well, I'm either going to work here or I'm going to go over there and make, you know, what it would be working here 3 years to one. So the dynamics of it were, I'm going to be back in a new place where I hadn't been, where a war is still going on. I was like, all right, well, this will give me a chance to see something different. And then that's when I was just like, all right, let me put, cause I was with that department for close to 3 years, 3.5 years. I was with them and then, left there to go overseas. And I was overseas for like the next 8 years. And it was one of the best jobs that I could ever have. Because I was finally getting paid at an acceptable rate. I was able to buy a house. I was able to live a life. I was able to do the things that, you know, while incurring so much debt previously, going to school and just trying to figure life out. You know, I think that was one of the hard realizations of getting out of the military, because everything was covered, everything was paid. And now you have like real expenses and real budgets and things that you have to put together. And if you don't, it's a slippery slope, where you can, you know, literally wake up and you're $80,000-$90,000 in debt and you're just like, well, how do I get out of this? So, for me, it was really cool just to have the opportunity of like, all right, well, I'm a paramedic. I'm a nationally registered paramedic now. You know, they needed that skill set overseas. I had the experience in combat. You know, it wasn't, you know, my experiences never led me to, or the PTSD that I had never led me to be cognitively impaired. It was more of, I don't want to say guilt, but it was a lot of heavy thoughts on what could have been done differently.
The moral injury side.
Yeah. And being over there at that time, you know, you're around different breeds, whether they were in SF, there were, you know, different mindsets and temperaments for the operational tempo that we were doing there as protectees that suited me, that suited us. And, you know, it kind of filled that void of tribe, you know, community, and, you know, being well paid to do a job that, you know, you expected, you've already signed the check, and when it gets cashed, but at least you're doing it in a way that, you know, you can see it coming versus being here in the States. You're just kind of like, this is fucking chaos. Like, what is actually happening here? So that's when I found like I really had to work on who I was and really started looking into other programs, looking into psychedelics, looking into different needs of who I was as a person. Because when I'd go overseas, you know, my blood pressure was, I think, call it, you know, 120 over 80. I come home like 190 over 100. And I'm just as I am right now, just whatever, but quick to ignite a fuse. And that wasn't good. It, you know, it really hurt a bunch of relationships along the way, for who I was versus now having more of an understanding and actually have done the work to get to the next level of where I wanted to be.
Well, it's interesting going back to what you were talking about in the interviews. When I put my very first pre-app in, it was actually down your way. It was one of those kind of conglomerates where you do one EMT test, one fire test, and they send the results to all the agencies. And Miami Beach was there and they had a pre-app. And again, like you, I was like, oh, well, obviously honesty is the most important thing. So yeah, years and years ago, I tried this and this, had a great time, never lost a job. And they literally, the guy screwed it up. And I remember him just throwing it at me and I was like, you're disqualified. And I'm like, huh. Okay, so you have to lie to get in the American Fire Service. Got it. And then from ever since then, I lied through polygraphs and all these things. And I'm not saying it to be an arrogant dickhead. I'm saying that basically all the assets that contributed to me being a good firefighter and a paramedic were completely ignored from this one little box checking bullshit, which now, by the way, those compounds are used for PTSD, and we'll get into psychedelics, but MDMA and psilocybin were the only ones I'd ever done. And disqualifying. And this is what is so broken. I've talked about this a lot. You know, in our professions, you have the MMPI, which is that psych test with all the thousands of questions. Yeah. And then the polygraph. The polygraph is a magic show done by some fucking tool bag that pretends to be the FBI's greatest profiler. And he gives his little speech. It's a beautiful monologue. It brought a tear to my eye. And then he does a smoke show. And then you go, no, I haven't done any of that stuff. And he goes, oh, wow, you beat the polygraph. Congratulations. And then you have the MMPI, which is psychology world, has said, by the way, that was never meant to be used as a standalone test, certainly to verify if someone could be a first responder or not. So both of those are bullshit. So I've been saying a lot recently, why not take the money that you're wasting on those, do a solid background check, of course, but then hire people that have had some of these things, knowing that so many of us have got shit in our past, and then give them counseling sessions. So now at the front door, Anthony Longo has the ability to start processing his early life, his time in Iraq, and then becomes an asset to, you know, aforementioned fire department. But instead we got, oh, no, check that box. Oh, no, 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 you're going to be a liability. We can't have you. Negating the other 99% of your lifeline that's going to be an absolute asset as a first responder.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, it's an accountability issue that I think a lot of the higher ups, when you get to that level, that they face. I mean, even now, even looking at what suicide rates are, looking at the demographics and what the recruiting pools are for each of those services, right? They're not far off from one another. There's some sort of emotional baggage that these individuals that we all carry bringing into the fire service that we either admit to or don't admit to, and it just just falls onto, you know, how much is your chain of command willing to go out of their way to put their neck out there for you? And it's not going to happen when they have a cushy salary.
Yeah, but it's the culture. This is the thing. We've got to reframe that completely and stop pretending like it's only altar boys that become police officers and firefighters. Bullshit.
Yeah,
we are people. And again, if you, the conversation is, you can have shit in your past, but if you work through it, if you find your toolbox, now that becomes an asset as a police officer, as a firefighter. You're going to be better, you know, under stress. You're going to be more compassionate. You're going to see yourself in some of these people that are struggling in society, and you will simply be better. But if we've got this box checking bullshit, that's how you end up with this promotional thing leaning towards, oh, you've got to have a degree. What the fuck is a degree? What does that actually mean as far as being boots on the ground, good at your job? It means nothing. So that's how disconnected we are between what we need to be doing to create great first responders and this academic box checking bullshit that we found ourselves in.
Yeah. I mean, it's, you look at the kids that just were able to go to school, they were able to complete a task and they did another 4 years. That was it. Just like, all right, great.
Yeah, I've got a degree, and the only real value to that degree is that I can tell people I've got a degree. So I'm like, who the fuck is this guy? Well, he's got a degree in ex-phys, so he must know something about. No, I learned all the stuff from coaching, from coaches, from actually coaching, from getting hurt, rehabbing injuries, not from that piece of paper that I got in a classroom.
Yeah, it's an interesting dynamic.
All right, we'll go into the other side. So before we get to some of the things that, you know, you were doing in Afghanistan, you mentioned starting your own healing journey and exploring this toolbox. And I think people don't realize how vast this toolbox actually is, from canines and you know, horses all the way through to psilocybin and, you know, ibogaine and everything in between. What was that journey of healing for you? Where did you find yourself finding success with some of these modalities?
Yeah, so for me, it started off with, you know, obviously having a great schedule, great work schedule. 105 days on, 35 days off. And, you know, being with a close-knit group, you start hearing what their travel experiences are and where they're going and, you know, parts of the world that they're finding themselves in, because we were all trying to make money. And we were all trying to preserve that money by staying out of our country for 330 days. So we were not taxed. And, you know, finding those opportunities of listening to what they did on their leave block and seeing who they were when they came back, you're just kind of like, wow, this is like, it's deep. And that attracted me to being able to have that much self-awareness of the process. And it led me to start reading more books on mindfulness and just the neurocog side of, you know, what can we do to develop these things or put systems in place that help us to be better and to improve our relationships, to improve communication. Because I think a lot of us, that's the one I think that sticks out to me the most is communication. I think we all have this huge void in our ability to effectively communicate without feeling as though we're either having somebody tear us down or tearing somebody else down, like making it so like we're losing our own identities when that's not the case. It's just a matter of like, okay, how many times do we have to do the same thing to really understand like, hey, this is a problem. And then what can we do to change that course? So when I started slowly, gradually getting introduced to psychedelics, I first initially started off with like microdosing and psilocybin and doing mushrooms, not in any controlled way, but just like exploring. And it was the post session that I really felt like the squelch box and the squawk box was off. Like it was the one time where my mind was not continuing to run an ultra marathon, where I was just like, oh wow, like I'm at peace right now with this. This is amazing. I can actually enjoy being around people who would I would generally just have a lit fuse being around, and it would help me kind of really understand what that relationship was for what it was and how I could be better for myself and restructure what I was doing to kind of fit that box. And I recognized that, hey, that only goes so far, right? Like there's only so many people that you're going to travel the same path before it bifurcates or it goes in another direction where it's just like, okay, we were just meant to do this. Fantastic. We can go this way and we're still going to be close, but we don't have to be, you know, we're not in like a deep relationship where we have to feel, you know, pissed off that, well, we're not friends anymore because we don't all do like the same shit. And that's what it helped me kind of understand. And the more that I went through and between, you know, psilocybin and then microdosing with LSD, and the nuances between the two of those were, you know, mushrooms that'll take you up and take you down. You got these ebbs and flows that are, you know, high highs, low lows, and waves, where LSD was very, you know, kind of like hitting the seek button where it just goes from channel to channel that's airing. So it was a cleaner, more just level-headed therapy session for me. And then it was all about the post where I was like really able to like, what, when I was in that space, what stood out? What did I have to work on? What did I have to earmark and say, hey, this is what's resonating with me. This is what's really kind of the ember of my fire of that, what aggravates me. How can I chip away at that and find new ways and be more productive with my own space and my healing? And which fast forward a couple of years later, you know, you start hearing everybody doing ayahuasca, you start seeing, you know, iboga and everything else kind of coming out. Then you hear about DMT and you're just kind of like, oh shit, like, I don't know if I need that. You're just like, whoa. And I felt as though, you know, with only being able to get so far, it was just like, I got to go deeper because I'm still holding on to shit. And is it me or is it the people around me? What am I doing? Because I feel like I'm still sticking square peg round hole. Like this is not what I want to have. And my first time doing 5-MeO-DMT, I was just like, what the fuck was that? Like, wow. Like, not so much the setting was my vibe, because it's kind of like being, you know, in a group setting, a circle, everybody's around you. And I didn't know anybody there except one of my buddies who was like, hey man, this is good. So I was like, all right, I'm following your lead. I'm going to lean on you. And ended up being my deep dive. It was just like crossed over, went completely black, really, really small speck of white far off into the distance. And then I kind of popped up and I was just like, after about 20 minutes of that, I popped out and I was just like, wow. And I you know, I kick myself in the ass now because I felt like I should have just stayed in and wrote it a little bit longer to really kind of conceptualize and gain more insight. But I was the first time where it was just like, I didn't have that blast. I blasted off, but I didn't have that like mental cog of hold on, keep holding. Like it was gone. It was like, let go. And once I figured that out, I was able to really, I was like, wow, I'm happy for this. I'm happy about that. And then I was absolutely petrified following the next like 15 sessions that we did, because it was just still like, I was trying to hold on. And finally I went out and I did a session by myself outside of the group. And I was really able to, like, you know, with being in nature and having, you know, just taking a deep breath in and feeling the wind wash over me in unison of me, you know, expelling a breath. I was just kind of like, I was able to, felt like, you know, those rubber band balls mm-hmm. in the office back in the day. It felt like an unshackling where it's like you were, if that was all of my anxiety, it was like taking a hot razor blade and just slicing strand by strand of where my mind was, and being able to navigate that and control that, to then being able to come back home and falling into just new habits and new making myself and learning how to love myself is really what it came down to. Not putting so much of your ego into, you're a piece of shit, you didn't get this done, you need to go harder, you need to be harder than everybody else there, you need to do this. And it's like, that's good for a certain point, but you still have to be able to look inside and still love yourself and give yourself some grace for some of the accomplishments. And I can say that now, but I still battle it every day where it's not like, yeah, dude, you're not where you need to be. You need to still go, but it's not as extreme as what it was, but it gave me hope that I was able to find something where it wasn't like I wanted to abuse this in any way, because I was just like fucking petrified to even do it again, where I was just like, nah, I'm good. Like that was, I got a lot of it. It, you know, it lasted, you know, 5 or 6 months. It really lasted up until, you know, to now, for a lifetime, I would say, because it gave me a lot of true value of insight. But the ability of just like feeling things that would piss you off normally, it's just like, why allow it to hold that real estate in your head? Why are you going to, like, for what reason? And then it translated to different relationships, and it just gave me a different sight picture, sight alignment of, you know, what my needs were, where I needed to be, who I needed to focus my energy on, who deserved my energy, who didn't, what relationships were just, you know, hey, that's a wash. There's no reason to hang on to this animosity towards people anymore. Where it's like, whatever, because they're not thinking about me. And if they are, so what? Big deal. So that was a huge turning point for me. And, you know, even with my dog, you know, who I've had at that point up until, I mean, he was probably, I would say 5 or 6 years old at that point. You know, I saw a vision or something of him. And then when I got home, from that experience, which was a whole other, you know, you're coming off 5-MeO DMT, then you got to go integrate with people. You know, it's like, dude, like, oh, fuck, here we go. Now I'm in, you know, the airport, and I'm just like, shit, I had to call up a buddy. I was like, hey, dude, I don't know, like, how I'm going to do this, because I got 5 hours on this flight, and, like, I got to fly all the way back here. Like, this is horrible. I definitely didn't plan correctly. So, you know, I'm an aisle seat, like, just strapped in and had my hands all tucked in. I'm just like, oh, man, like, this is going to be bad. Like, I feel bad for the dude next to me. He's like, who's this psychopath? But when I got home, it was like, I just told my mother, I was like, hey, look, don't ask me any questions. I don't know anything right now. But I do know that I just need a minute. I just need time. And my dog, I was just looking at him. I was like, was that you? And it, for the first time, like, you know, there was an experience and connection that, you know, with back and forth to Afghanistan, coming home, there was never a, like, being reunited with him in a sense of from that day. Like, he was literally, after I asked that question, spinning all over me in the front passenger seat, blowing his coat all over the vehicle. And I'm like, like, was that you? That was you, wasn't it? And he just, like, he would go even more. And I was just like, this is wild. And we got back to the house, and I literally slept for probably 2 or 3 days after that, of just trying to, like, all right, let me walk outside. Let me reinstitute some of these tasks that I had planned for myself as far as my journey goes of here's what I want to do. Here's what I want to build on to be able to take that in. And I was just like, you know, I could really sense the difference of who I was and what I wanted to become. And that gave me a lot of hope of like, okay, it's going to be fine. Life is not that fucking bad anymore. Like life is actually very simple. People make this shit very hard. You know, it's just one of those things where you get that 50,000 foot overview of like, okay, we're all just plugged into this system, this matrix. Like, what are we doing? How do we stop it? And it was a really a breath of fresh air that I was able to get from that experience.
As I'm hearing more and more and getting deeper into all these different healing modalities, but especially when it comes to the psychedelics, the plant medicines, one thing that's now, I think the next phase is, and then I just had Kagan Gill on the show, who's a friend of mine. We went around the world together on 7X with Patrick.
Yeah, great dude.
And he's got this thing, I think it's called Mind Dojo. I might have that wrong. But anyway, so you do a psychedelic journey, you have these eye-opening experiences, but then there's a lot of people that just, oh, and then 6 months I go do it again. And his whole thing is, and I'm sure the people he surrounds himself with, is that, all right, you've opened the door, but now you need to work through all the things that you just found. And so you have meditation and breath work and, you know, time in nature and, you know, time with animals, whatever the things are. What has been your experience of that, the awakening that you had with the psychedelics versus what needs to come next?
Yeah, I think the awakening was, you know, again, it comes down to self-love. What is the underlying thing that motivates you, that where you're happy in your own skin, you're at peace, and you understand, and you kind of have this seventh sense or enhanced sixth sense of just being able to see the right people that you want to align with. And this makes me happy. I feel comfortable here, or they're pushing me in a way that this is conducive to my growth. And it really just came down to what were those deficiencies? How hard are you going to work on them? What are the steps that you're going to put into place? Because like you said, it's like, hey, yeah, you can go do this 6 months. And then 6 months later, you're finding yourself having to go back and do it again. Because did you even work on, or did you just fall back into thinking like this was going to be a one-off and I'm good, I'm solid, it takes everything away? It's a lot of, you know, relationships, like what the toxic relationships that you find yourself in, that you get involved with, and that you don't want to get away, and that's communication. It's just like there's so many things that I was able to take away from that to understand, like, I didn't want to be involved with toxic relationships. I didn't want to be a contributing factor to that in any way. It's hard to explain, like, the number of lessons that were learned, because you come back normal when it all settles. Like, you're still a normal human being following that. You just learn ways of how to digest it and what you need to digest. And, you know, if you're just in a shitty situation and you're just lying to yourself and you're going to continue lying to yourself because you're trying to make something work, You're not gonna find yourself healing. You're always gonna find yourself compromising for another individual or for another situation, versus standing up for yourself and being like, "Hey, as much as this is gonna fucking suck to have to start over, here are the potential outcomes if I do, and here's where I'm gonna be happy. Here's where I'm like," so you have to weigh those out case by case. And you know, fortunately for me, never married, no children. You know, most of my adult life has been spent overseas. So for me coming home, it was just always like, all right, hey, this is all fun. This is great. But then starting the organization, you know, coming back and working with individuals, who have a lot of multi-system traumas and just mental health issues, knowing that I could bear the weight of assisting them and helping them through their path through the dogs, that's really kind of where I felt my need, because it was like, look, here's one tool. The dog is a tool. It's not an end all be all. Like, you know, it can be life-changing if you want it to be. But looking at a proprioceptive neurocog dog and what we were building out and how we wanted to see things happen for an individual with a TBI, brain injuries, mental health, whatever the case is, it gives you that moment, space, and time of just nothing fucking matters except for this moment that you're with your dog right now, troubleshooting and problem solving, and to having a hand in a purpose to what you're doing for yourself. Because it's my dog, it's my property, it's my thing that I'm working for myself and my overall mental health, nobody else. And it gives you that time and place of just shutting down and focusing on what your needs are. And a lot of us don't ever admit to, what do I like to do? Like, it's hard for me to say, well, I like to do this. I like to do a bunch of shit. But what can I say? Like, I really love to do and sitting down and where it, like, it's not work. It's like this, whatever, man, I'm training dogs. I'm having a great time. I'm helping people. I'm coordinating. I'm plugging holes and doing logistical stuff. Like, I'm able to help people get to the next level in their life and save a couple lives here and there, where I can, or if I can in that process. And that for me was what I found with the dogs, and to be able to just, you know, think about being in a shitty relationship with your wife or just constantly fucking just getting yelled at all the time. Now it's like, hey, I got to take the dog outside. Hey, I'm going to take him for a ride. We're going to go here. We're going to go train, you know? And I think it's, for the programming that we built, it gives that person the ability, to take a pause in the day to go focus on themselves and to find that meditative state. Cause for some of us, meditation for me is very hard. My flow state is chaos, I guess, in a sense where I have to have a bunch of things going because I can just naturally just move through and find the resources in Solve for X where, you know, sit me down and say, hey, go to the beach. You're going to hang out here all day. I will be crawling out of my skin like, fuck, I'm sweating. It's so fucking hot. I'm getting all sandy. Like, I don't want to be here. This is terrible. Seeing everybody run around, dogs going crazy. I'm just like, oh, God. So that's kind of, I guess, an essence of being able to identify solutions for yourself. It comes down to self-love.
What about performance? I think one of the most powerful tools when it's the naysayer, when it's the guy or woman who kind of doesn't buy into the whole mental health conversation in the fire service, for example, and say, all right, then Rockstar, if you truly want to be the best version of yourself as a firefighter, firstly, you need to change your work week. And I know Palm Beach with Pat is, you know, they've gone to the 24/72. So I'll just slide that in there. The department is finally getting it. But secondly, you know, if you want to get in the flow state, you've got to have 10,000 reps. You've got to have high stress. And then you've got to have a clear mind. So if you look at Delta and some of these tier one operators, they are working with all these organizations that ironically work really well with mental health, also for performance. So it's a win-win situation. What were you seeing as far as your ability to operate as you were on this healing journey?
Good question. I was able to itemize and what I needed to compartmentalize, what needed attention and what didn't need attention. And for me, that was, you know, the ability of, hey, go to the gym, go do this, go work out. It was, you know, establishing new relationships. It was being able to sit and have peer support groups where you're talking to individuals who you admire, you look up to, whether it's in business, whether it's in your occupational field, whether it's in just a simple area of interest. It's diversifying that portfolio to find new tools for the toolkit that you could put into your everyday system. It's like a software update of being able to think, oh, well, I got this. I learned this from this guy. Let me try this. And oh, this is working well for me. Let's continue to roll with this. And I think it's like those small little victories to be able to appreciate small victories is probably the biggest thing that I think I learned. If I'm understanding the question correctly, I think that was where, you know, we all kind of get lost in the sense of, especially if you're running your own business, if you're doing something, and Elon Musk said it great. It's like, as a CEO or an executive in a higher level position, you're always eating glass. You're never really celebrating the wins of what you do accomplish, because you're always faced with the problems. You're always faced with what didn't go right. How do I fix this? How do I increase these different spends and whatever I have to do, to where you're never really looking at the momentum that everybody sees of like, oh, well, you helped this. Oh my God, you put this dog here. You've done this. Like, we've had some great individuals that we were able to work with, who have helped me grow in so many different ways. And I was just happy to be like that one speck, a part of their life, to help them change their thing. And that's created a brotherhood in itself, of always being able to have someone to reach out to and call and respect, and, you know, understanding those different relationships and how they can, I don't want to say be transactional to a degree, but to be able to have a true meaningful friendship in a way that it's mutually beneficial.
Absolutely. Well, I want to get to the dogs, obviously the impact on yourself and then creating a nonprofit. But just before we do, talk to me about the US compound attack.
So that was in 2005. We had just stood up a new team up at Alvarado off of at the airport in Kabul. And we were all out there just kind of hanging out, doing whatever. You know, I think we just got done playing freaking cornhole or something like that. And it was right around 1700, maybe even like 1800, whatever. You felt this explosion go off. And this was just like, ooh, fuck. And it's like, you know, you're kind of like, damn, whoever's on that, like, they got fucked up. Like, you knew that there was like, all right, hey, we're just waiting to see where that was. And it just so happened to be just outside of Abbey Gate, where this VBID rolled up through this alleyway and just deaded. And then it was in between two compounds. One was an American compound, which literally, I mean, you're looking at 20-foot T-walls. And if nobody has an understanding what that is, think of the T-walls on the side of the road that they put in for crowd control or whatever, but just add another, you know, 15 feet onto that, dusted, like gone. You know, windows blown out, shipping containers that we used to live in, those were just dumped over, peeled over. The majority of the infrastructure inside that, I mean, it was just like vaporized. And then you see this, you know, this monster crater, where it's like 15, 20 feet wide, freaking almost 10 feet deep. You're just like, fuck. Okay. You see the driver who skipped off one of the other T walls that was still there, and his body was over here. And, you know, you roll through, you know, in being that it was a mass CAS, you had guys that were stuck under equipment. You had things. So there was a lot of logistics. Unfortunately, our QRF team, you know, we were responsible for that type of incident if it were to happen. So when we rolled in, set up a perimeter, move in. And then from there, it's just a matter of like, hey, jumping on bodies and like, hey, start just mass triage. This person's got to go here. This has got to happen here. And at that point, everybody was just getting shuffled out and going right to the hospital that they had at the airport. And then from that, it was just the next few days going through debris removal, trying to get things set up and, you know, holding perimeter, holding security, to make sure that void that was just created was protected and secured. So for the most part, it was just an incident that we responded to. It was lasted all throughout the night for the next few days, just pulling bodies. And, you know, fortunately there were only minor injuries sustained for some of the Americans. There were only a few deaths on the local national side, and some of the other embassies or agencies, contractors that were in that vicinity experienced some casualties as well. But we were able to, the people that we were able to work on, we were able to get out, and that was pretty much the sum of that incident.
That's horrendous, though. I mean, especially triage. I haven't actually had a mass cache that size, at least. I had one in LA, but I wasn't on the triage team. But just to have to walk around, you know, and tag people appropriately, and even if someone is, you know, circling the drain, putting a black tag on, basically, is, I can't imagine, especially if children are involved. I mean, that's one of the most brutal thing that any kind of first responder or emergency personnel are going to have to do.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's like, you know, you train for it because it's like you're with a bunch of capable men and women. For us, our team was predominantly male infused. So for us, it was like, you know, in the event, even if we did get shot, it's like, hey, man, if you can walk, you can move, put your shit on, let's go. Like, so systematically, you get it down, and you're so, you know, from experience, it's like, you know, you're just structured, compartmentalized. Like, hey, this, you just quick look over glance. Like, hey, no, this dude's got to go. We got to move this guy. So yeah, it was definitely an interesting time.
I can imagine. Well, let's get back to the dogs then. I meant to ask that earlier, so I wanted to put that in there. You have this moment where you come back, now your dog's putting fur all over the car and spinning around you in circles. Talk to me first about your kind of awakening when it came to that connection with your own canine.
So interestingly enough, I secured my dog 4 years in advance to that. So for me, I picked him out at 3 days old. He's like this little hamster, literally just born. Didn't even have his eyes open yet. And we started doing neurostim, which was, you know, adopted by the military to induce stress on an animal. So that this way later on in life, that dog would easily be able to handle stress more efficiently than dogs that don't have it. And, you know, from that point, you know, he and I were connected together. It took some time for our relationship to develop. And, you know, within that process of working him through those years, it gave me that purpose of being able to focus on myself. It gave me the interest. It gave me, you know, essentially another hobby of being able to look at and read and break down what the animal was telling me versus, you know, the everyday relationship. Hey, man, you want to go outside and throw the ball? It's like, of fucking course he does. But really, like, what were his needs too? And where I was deficient as a handler to really kind of map out and look at ways of improving our relationship by being able to clear up my communication. And, you know, with that, it was, you know, understanding the reward cycle, being able to mark and maneuver and do a whole bunch of different things. And I always try to tell, you know, individuals like guys I work with or even some private clients, you know, what you want to focus on today is going to be looking into a kaleidoscope. It's like, oh shit, what do I got to do? Where do I start? Well, you just start small and you work your way up. You perfect one thing and then you kind of move on, but you add pressure. You're always kind of going back to that one thing. And from there, it laid the groundwork of being able to be present, be mindful, be understanding, and coming into that space of, okay, this is something that I can resonate with. It wasn't something that was just given to me. I had to earn that relationship with my animal and obviously with the people around me as well. But it really just kind of brought my ability to escape and go be with my dog, do what I wanted to do, and a way to connect with other people who had similar interests. And, you know, traveling with him for the first time, you know, we went to Costa Rica. He was 7 months old. So we did a flight from, where did we go? We went from Palm Beach to the 2014 All-Star Game, where it was Derek Jeter's last All-Star Game. So I was like, I have to go. I'm finally on leave. So we went up to Minneapolis. First time I've been home. First time I've ever, like, well, second time I've been ever in Minneapolis. First time I've ever been there where I actually know what the hell is happening, what's going on. And, you know, I had my dog. We went to the Home Run Derby. Then we went to the All-Star Game. And then following that trip, we shot down to Costa Rica and spent like 14 days in Costa Rica. well, little that I know, like my first Malinois, I didn't know any different. You know, we're getting ready, you know, having a great time. He's running around and doing a whole bunch of, you know, bad dog shit, just having a good time. And, you know, we're getting ready to leave. Next thing you know, we have the whole house locked up downstairs. We thought everything was locked up downstairs or upstairs, went downstairs, started cleaning up, getting ready to put stuff in our rental. Next thing you know, we're outside just doing a quick, you know, final walkthrough. And next thing you know, he opens a window. We come to find out, scales a roof, hops on a vehicle, and is just running around like, "Hey, where are you guys going? Like, don't leave me. Like, I'm here." And I'm just like, "What the fuck? Like, dude, didn't you lock the dog? Like, I don't want to lose this dog. He'd be running off in the jungle." And no, it was just like my first time there. I was just like, okay. And then at the airport, we're delayed for 8 hours. Didn't get out of the airport for like 8 hours. So we're just sitting there. I'm just like, oh my God. But it was just so refreshing to kind of have that escape and be able to have that animal there where nothing else mattered. The situation didn't affect me nearly as much because I had something that I could lean into and lean on that was there for me as much as I was for him. And, you know, fast forward a couple years, I end up getting another dog. And that ends up being our breeding bitch for our program. And right as I got out, I started the organization in 2016, didn't take it live until 2017, 2018, where I did my first litter. And then that first litter was a whole learning curve of having a bunch of little Malinois puppies running around. And I don't know too many people who know this, but they're little terrorists that straight up will ruin anything that you like. They'll fucking destroy it if you're not paying attention to them. If they're quiet, they're just tearing shit up. Like, you have like, all right, where are you? But it allowed me to really reflect on, hey, you know, using the hypervigilance and all of those things that kind of equated towards PTSD and what we're thinking about, it gave me the ability to focus on my dog, and it gave me something to worry about or to constructively utilize that tool I was given to place that into my animal and into the work that I was performing. So with the puppies, it just came out. It was awesome. It was just a unique experience where, you know, we were able to link dogs up with some really cool individuals and people that needed them. And then that just kind of slowly progressed into where we're at today. And tying guys in with coming in, literally living with us for up to 5 weeks in my own home, you know, learning how to cook dinners or do stuff and doing events, recreational activities, that were interested, or they were at least at one point in their life interested in. And, you know, to be able to give that back to them. And also on top of that, give back a dog that would be able to change them in their direction, trajectory of life. That was like something super meaningful to me. You know, because as a medic, you want to help somebody. You want to, you know, you can read a person. It's like, all right, well, sick, not sick. That's easy. You go through everything that's learned. And then you just kind of map out and start tailoring dogs to, you know, what this person's needs are going to be, where you can see deficiencies in the dog and in the person, in the handler, because you have enough experience with enough dogs under your belt to know, like, okay, this is going to drive this person or this isn't. So that kind of set the tone for us.
Absolutely. I've had two German Shepherds now. I had them growing up, and then there was a period for a long time where I didn't have any. Then we had Shih Tzus with my first wife, which didn't, I mean, they were sweethearts, but when I had my little son, the kind of pack mentality became dangerous. So we ended up giving them to a couple that we knew, and they had them right the way until they passed away, which is amazing. But so yeah, I had my first Shepherd, and she absolutely has been, you know, my foundation. Cause as you hear a lot of people say, you know, even if you're deeply depressed, that dog still needs to be walked. It needs to be fed. It needs to be watered, you know, and it gives you a purpose outside yourself. But I want to put a question to you. I've got a little 3-year-old German Shepherd now. I lost my other one a couple of years ago. And she is a sweetheart, you know, and I do, you know, a lot of walks with her, and then we do, you know, the bowls and the games, and she's, I would argue, pretty obedient. But my God, the anxiety before a walk and the anxiety in the car, the whining and the spinning around. I know it's always us that we're doing something wrong. I've tried Ritalin stuff. I've tried the dog whisperer stuff. when you look at all these people and all the right ways of doing it, all the wrong ways of doing it, when it comes to that kind of anxiety, what is the kind of common denominator that we're missing? That, because I mean, obviously that's a barrier to that particular animal being, you know, a service dog at the moment. They can't be out in public or on a plane if they're going to be spinning around and whining for 9 hours. So what are some of the issues that you see with us as far as creating some of these behaviors?
I think brass tacks is anthropomorphizing with the animal. I think it's like you give animals human traits, where it's like you find a sense of like trying to give them the attention you would to a human. And it's recognizing, all right, how do I break this down? How can I reward behaviors where if I did something different to change up what was causing that anxiety, or finding a way to harness that drive and make it work for me in a constructive way, especially if it's something where it's just like aggravating, where you're like, fuck, just stop. Like, all right, come on, let's go. You know, I get it. You know, it's really being able to communicate with the dog of like, hey, let's take a step back. Let me maybe put you on place. Let's hold you here. I'm going to come up to you when you settle and you're quiet. I'm going to come closer. I'm going to give you what you want. And then you slowly take those wins and you gradually progress, in being able to put the brakes on the dog. Cause a lot of people, you know, their animals are all gas and there's no brakes. So you have to be able to manage, you know, those expectations and those realities, even with your dog. Even our dogs have, you know, I don't want to say liabilities, but they have tendencies to do X, Y, and Z. So it's like, hey, you need to be cognizant of this. And this is how we work through these problems together. But in essence, if a dog's super excited, you know, you give them the possession by working in closely once they've settled. And you have to make sure that they're clear with that. So it's like, you know, when they know that they're going for a walk, they're super excited. You have that routine down. Maybe it's switching up the routine. Maybe it's getting away from what's already previously known to maybe doing something a little bit different, to where you capture the dog off beat, but they're paying attention to you. And then now you have that capture where you can begin doing what you want to do, and changing or modifying those behaviors.
What about as far as rewarding what would be the animal's correct behavior? Are you using food normally?
Yeah. So we generally have, you know, food driven dogs, that at least I like to use food driven dogs. But if you have a ball or if you have something, it's making sure that the transaction, is very clear and what they're doing. And, what I mean by that is like, hey, when they're down, it's, hey, yes, boom, here's your ball, or yes, boom, here's your food. You know, we use clickers. I think clickers are easy because it's easy for me to transfer the dog over, with a clicker, so that the end user knows and, you know, can understand the reward system. But I think once you have a dialed in reward system, and you understand left and right lateral limitations, then I mean, that's any relationship, right? So I think you get a better product with just defining what that reward system looks like.
Brilliant. Well, I appreciate that. That is just personally for me.
Yeah.
All right. Well, then before we talk about where everyone can find the nonprofit, and we'll talk about some closing questions, what are some success stories that really kind of resonate with you as far as this program so far?
Oof. I think the successes that we've had in being able to put out close to 46 dogs at this point, a number of medical retreats and just retreats in general, the end users of who we've been able to work with, whether it's, you know, MARSOC Marines, Navy SEALs, Green Berets, you know, whoever from the special operations community, it's just finding that they're bought into themselves. Like, you've given them the ability to have some level of independence and that they're going to be okay. And, you know, sometimes it doesn't work out. I had a really, really close friend who took his life last year. And that shocked me, because it's like, we had normalized these conversations of suicide to the point where it's like, dude, just call me, whatever. Come, I don't give a fuck if you show up day of. Just come to the house and you'll be fine. Don't worry about anything, don't, whatever. So that really rocked me, because we thought we had that open dialogue. And it's like, the successes, I think, is just knowing that you can't save everybody, but as long as you're helping one person at a time, and you see the difference of how it translates them and how it impacts their lives, that's been a large success. All the personal stuff, man, like, been awarded for certain, that doesn't mean shit for me, because it's not about, you know, the awards, it's, you know, and the glory of it, because to me it's like, I'd rather put myself out of business now and not have to worry about this shit, so that we know that we're doing the right thing and it's being, you know, and it's effectively managed. But I'm just happy that the people who we've been able to touch and the people who see our program, see what we're doing, knowing that we're not a one trick pony, knowing that it's like, really, it's your choice to be here, because we don't owe anybody anything. Like, the reason why you're coming to us is, you know, whether it's for a dog or whether it's for, you know, some of the other services that we offer, it's just a matter of you wanting to be in that headspace to heal and being open enough to receive those lessons of whatever you might be able to take away from that to implement and strategize into your life. So I think that's probably the most gracious gift that I've been able to value as, you know, proven performance, is like, hey man, I've worked with some bad dudes and they're good right now. Like, they're in a position where it's like, you don't have to worry about them. Or if you do, we have a tight network where it's, hey man, I'm struggling. And it's just like, all right, well, what can we do? So I think that's probably the most glory that I can take away from any of that. Cause it's a shitty thing, man. It's like, you're constantly dealing with, you know, that space in your head where it's like, you're either not good enough, you're not this, like, what the fuck am I doing this? Like, I need my own help. I, like, you know what I mean? It's just like, it's always a back and forth. It's always moving the goalposts, always trying to strive. So I would just say that the people that we've been able to work with and the people who believe in our program and who understand it, who have reached out, who communicate, that's probably the biggest success.
Beautiful. Well, yeah. Where can people find it if they want to actually be part of the program or if they simply want to donate?
Yeah. So if they want to find us, it's www.warriorschoice.org. You can find us on Instagram at Warriors Choice Foundation, social media, what other app around. Facebook is at Choice Warriors. We have an event coming up next weekend, which is where I think we were first supposed to link up with the CrossFit Sea Dog Summer Showdown, which is a fitness competition, where this will be our third year hosting the adaptive athlete division. So it's one thing that we wanted to bring to this, where it's like, hey man, we got dudes that have been blown up. It's like, no, you can still compete. You can still do this. Where, you know, it's really about giving back to that, to those individuals who, you know, hate to say it, like, they feel like they can't do that, but it's like, no, you can, let's go. Let's see, you know, every year, same time. But, yeah, social media, Instagram, you can call us, reach out. And that's pretty much, if you want to get involved with us, that's how you do it.
Beautiful. Well, I want to throw some quick closing questions at you if you've got time.
Absolutely.
So the first one I love to ask, is there a book or are there books that you love to recommend? It can be related to our discussion today or completely unrelated.
Yes. The Talent Code, I think it's by David Coyle. Tribe by Sebastian Younger. I do like Jocko's book. Let me see what that was. The
Extreme Ownership, that one?
Extreme Ownership, yeah. That one. Yeah, I think those would be my top right now.
Brilliant.
There's a lot to take away from that.
Absolutely. Well, what about films and documentaries?
Oof. Films and documentaries. I think it's just find the voice that connects with you and listen to that. Was it Dr. Hubert? He, the dude out came from Cali.
Huberman.
Yeah. To listen to him talk and to, you know, it's great. Find a podcast that, you know, that resonates around the same people and the same thought processes that you have and try to dive in and just, you know, continue to learn and teach yourself. Movies though, man, I love movies, but it's so hard to, like, you know, based on theatrics, it's just like, I don't know. I'll have to get back to you on that one. I'll send some to you.
Yeah, no problem at all. All right. Well, the next question, is there a person that you recommend to come on this podcast as a guest to speak to the first responders, military, and associated professions of the world?
Oh, 100%. I think Pat Burrows absolutely needs to get on. I think a buddy of mine, Tom Heaton. I think another buddy of mine, Andrew Arabito. I think Morgan Stahl. Definitely, I'll definitely call out Morgan again in a heartbeat. I can definitely send you out a list, man. There's a bunch of good dudes that I've been able to surround myself with, who can really kind of tell their story and give out some new light and hope, because, you know, we're all going through some shit, man. It's just a matter of who do you resonate with.
100%. Yeah, and you hit on the word hope. That's it. That's the project I'm working on. I'm turning my book into a show at the moment. And I say I'm beginning the process, but it's going to happen. And that's just it. You know, I think this mental health story in some areas has become a very doom and gloom kind of portrayal. And it was stuck on the word stigma, which doesn't fucking mean anything. And I think what we need is the hope of post-traumatic growth, the hope of the version of you that's done the work and is now a beacon of light for others.
Yeah. Cause, you know, I think about it and it's like that led me to this, right? Like my traumatic experience of being on the battlefield, being shot at, being in a really fucked up situation, when it was all said and done, led me to never want to be in a position where I couldn't help somebody or I couldn't perform to give somebody the type of aid that they needed. And, you know, maybe that's my survivor's guilt of whatever. But for me, it was a reflection of I could still function. I could still do what I wanted. I was still very clear cognitively. Now, next step was, what could I do? Because I didn't have any medical training other than, hey, put a tourniquet on it, take your pill pack, and that's it. It's a total different story when a dude needs a crike and this, and you're like, what the fuck do I do? I'm in the back, like, keep the red shit in the body. Okay. You know, so I think it comes down to taking those moments that you think compartmentalize you or drowned you, and finding the good in it and the lesson that was supposed to be taught, and strategizing on how to build from that.
Absolutely. All right. Well, the last question before we just kind of reiterate where to find you, what do you do to decompress?
What do I do to decompress? I go out to the woods with my dog and do absolutely, I try to like get out of cell phone range. Like I try to like put my cell phone in the microwave and just go somewhere where, like, dude, I just, whether it's fishing, whether it's, you know, going up, having breakfast with Pat and his family in the morning and just, you know, with my girlfriend and his family, it's just like one of those things that, go out and explore new cuisines. And I just like to do a number of things, kind of like just roll through it to find, to laugh, to cry. It's, you know, it's one of those things that you just got to be in touch with yourself to know, hey, it's okay to break down once in a while and have that moment. And, you know, you're not a pussy for it. It's just a matter of like, dude, you know, watching a rom-com or watching some sport movie that you can resonate with, like, oh man, that's a tearjerker. Fuck. All right. You know, I can see, look at the good in humanity, you know, so it's like, you know, for me, it's just a matter of trying to, whatever way I can unplug and not, and just try to focus on myself, which is a daunting task at times, I think. But, that's pretty much it, man. Just travel and being around people that you care about and that you love, you know, surround yourself with quality, high quality people for high quality outcomes. Otherwise, you know, your square peg round hole. If it's not working, you're not going anywhere with it. Fuck you doing with it. Get rid of it.
It's funny about the stigma with crying. Like, I've got go-to songs and films if I need to get some shit out that I'll put on. But you think about, you know, obviously war, but you think about sports, you know, whether they won, whether they lost, you know, the raw emotion that comes out then. But yet there's this bullshit facade like men don't cry, which I would argue came from the John Waynes and Schwarzeneggers who had never actually served in their life. You know, they're actors that, you know, and no disrespect to them, but they are not manly men at all. They are portraying manly men in a terrible way. So, you know, and we bought into that. Our generation totally bought into that kind of Hollywood facade of masculinity versus that, you know, you look at the real men of Easy Company talking on Band of Brothers. They're in tears numerous times relaying that. And that was 70 plus years before. So that's what a man is.
Yeah. I mean, those dudes were built different too. Like, that's a whole other fucking breed. That was just like, because, I mean, when I went to Normandy, I was just like, you did what? Like, just thinking back of all, like, the movies that you've watched, you're just like, fuck that. Like, no thank you.
Yeah, no GPS, you know, Overwatch, none of that.
Doors open, go in, and Germans, the fortified bunkers, like, to see the bunkers, to, like, that's one of the things that one of my favorite trips was being able to go to Normandy and look at some of the World War II and then World War I when I went to Bellwood, where it was just like, it's unbelievable what these men had gone through to get us to the point of where we are today, and to see the types of infrastructure, see how fast it was built, to see all the engineering that went into it. And you're just like, wait, we just bodies in droves just came in to swarm and overwhelm and to get us to this point. It's remarkable to just the tenacity of who we are as humans to overcome that for a belief and just a moral. Yeah. So it's just like, wow.
It's interesting because I've had so many conversations now, and you know, either if it's an older guest, dad, but more often granddad was in the war, and we romanticize about that generation. What they did was incredible, but we romanticize, and then they just came back and they rolled up their sleeves and they went to work, and no, they were a fucking mess. Listen to what granddad was actually like. That absolutely took a toll, and that environment, they weren't able to talk about it like we do today. So we owe it to that generation to heal ourselves, because I mean, I was just having a conversation with someone right before you and I sat down. What I see now in a lot of the things that are wrong with our society is broken people at the helm of whether it's a presidential, you know, seat that they're occupying, whether it's the head of Purdue Pharma or William Morris Tobacco, where their decisions are costing, you know, in some cases, hundreds of thousands of American lives, and they sleep like a baby at night. So left unaddressed, the trauma from World War II and beyond is still rippling today. And so if we really want to honor the men and women of the World War II generation, we bind back together and we start healing our communities, because I see the opposite as a real kind of push. And that's such a spit in the face for the men and women that fought for the liberty in the first place.
Yep. Yeah, it's wild, man. If you've not been to Normandy, I recommend it. And any of the viewers who haven't, go. Like, it's a vibe. It's, you know, to witness that and to just see the remnants of what it was. It's just like, it puts a whole new, it's like, life's not that bad right now, you know, with all that's happening, with all they're finding right now, with, you know, not having to get too political, but it's just, it's astounding to see, like, it's gone that long for this country to be this much in debt and all this fucking chaos of, you know, what? So,
Yeah, we can, I think, again, if we refine that community that they had back then, where it was truly a selfless service mentality, I think we truly could make America great again. But it's not going to be from a politician. I tell you that right now, it's going to be from us.
Yeah, no, absolutely. As a community, being able to bind together and understand that there's a better alternative way to see things done. And, you know, even look at the numbers based on, you know, suicide deaths for first responders. You know, and how that gets reported. You know, how many reports have you been kicked back with over the years where, oh, this is off, this is wrong, but okay, let's go find out how many firefighters just killed themselves. Where are the reports and statistical values for us to be able to look at in real time, not wait 4 years later to then be like, oh, well, maybe we got to do something about it. It's like, okay, how about after year one, we come to the table and look at it. Okay, here's where we need to change. These are the different programs that we can explore and look at. Even just having a dog in the fire station after a significant event might be able to do something. It doesn't cost anybody anything other than the fucking dog and whoever his handler is to bring it in. You know, so it's like even just changing up one thing. But dude, some of these guys are just stuck in their they're in their own way of actually making real changes because they don't want to piss off the mayor. They like it's whatever.
Yeah,
you know, it's a cycle.
Yeah, it's going to change though. It is. Yeah. I mean, I think firstly the work week conversation is a revolution that's begun. The thing that I'm working on this show, I hope will, you know, put our story front and center in every living room and cell phone in the States, at least, if not internationally. And then people are going to ask a lot of questions. Well, wait a second. I thought that, you know, the firefighting, you know, it was easy and they just sat around and, you know, pet the Dalmatian, and people are going to realize it's not the case. And then hopefully, like I said, that hope conversation too, like if, you know, whoever's out there, whatever level of struggle you're at, that there are solutions and here they are. So, but I mean, everyone that's part of this puzzle that's doing this for the right reason, not for their own career, you know, or personal gain, I think that's going to be the next renaissance, the renaissance of kindness and compassion. As I see the fractured, you know, the Jenga block starting to wobble in this whole self-serving monopoly, you know, I'm the most important person in the world bullshit that to me is the opposite of what we just said, that the World War II generation. So I'm looking forward to seeing kindness and compassion finally win again.
Yeah, it's going to be nice.
All right. Well, then just for everyone to reiterate, where are the best places to find the nonprofit and also if they want to reach out to you personally?
Yeah, best place to find us is warriorschoice.org, or you can find us on social media at Warriors Choice Foundation or at Choice Warriors between X and between Facebook. And then personally, if you want to reach out to me, a.longo@warriorschoice.org is probably the best way to get in touch with me. I generally don't answer numbers that I don't know. So if anything, shoot me an email. I'm pretty responsive at that point. I'm stuck on a computer most days. So I don't really get to do the fun shit anymore. Now it's more management, delegation, all that other stuff. But yeah, reach out to me anytime. Anybody who's struggling, just go to our website, put in an app, put in a request, and we'll be in touch. We have a phone number there. We're actually going to be relaunching a website. So there'll be more ways of being able to find resources and get plugged into where you got to get plugged into.
Beautiful. Well, I want to say thank you firstly for your vulnerable, you know, courageous storytelling and being vulnerable yourself. And then like so many people having served and worn multiple uniforms, still wanting to continue to serve. And I think even in the transition, you know, conversation, the people who ultimately do well, I think, realize that you were always a selfless servant, that you always wanted to help people. And the military costume or the fire costume was just that. It was a costume. It was clothing that you wore at that period. But now, you know, so many people that leave, you know, the first responder professions or the military, and they end up doing what you're doing, that they still serve in whatever capacity. So I want to thank you so much for everything that you're doing for our community and the military community. And also for being so generous with your time and coming on the Behind the Shield podcast today.
Yeah, man, I appreciate it. Thanks for having me on. Thank you. And thanks, Pat.